Good morning. I'm Steve Brown, your host today for Education Matters. On today's program, two segments. My first guest is Wisconsin State Superintendent Dr. Jill Underley. And in segment two, I'll be talking with Matthew Frazier, whose U.S. Supreme Court case of Bethel v. Frazier is still one of the landmark First Amendment cases. And I am very pleased and very honored to have as our guest this morning on Education Matters, Dr. Jill Underley, who is State Superintendent of Public Instruction here in Wisconsin. Dr. Underley, welcome.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brown. I'm really happy to be here.
You were elected back in 2021, and I could read a short bio, which I won't do. And maybe if you could just give our listeners kind of a quick overview of your background and what led you to decide to run for state superintendent.
Yeah, of course. So we're coming up on 2 years now. It'll be April of 21, like you said, and then here we are in 23. So 2 years in, so halfway through, I have a background as a social studies teacher and at the high school level mostly. And then I was an elementary principal. I was a high school principal. I worked at the Department of Public Instruction once before under, Governor Evers when he was state superintendent. I also have experience working in higher education at the UW-Madison in student affairs. And then my most recent position was as a school district superintendent in rural southwestern Wisconsin. And I think it was a combination of all those experiences plus the fact that I'm the parent of two children in Wisconsin public schools that led me to run for this role. I saw a need, you know, as far as making sure that we had that through line of, you know, early childhood all the way through elementary, middle, high, and then through the higher education experience of, you know, opportunities for all kids. And I, you know, I speak about kids with disabilities. I speak about kids coming from communities that are in poverty and just making sure that they all had these opportunities to be their best selves. And that's honestly what propelled me to run.
Mm-hmm. I know in an interview you did, you talked, the question was, what is your top priority as state superintendent if elected? This is when you were running. And you said that your platform was rooted, as you just related to, in equity and getting every child what they need each and every day. And that means prioritizing. And you went through a list of very, very important areas. As you look at the last 2 years now of being, almost 2 years of being a state superintendent, are you still, are those still important areas for you? And how does that relate to your day-to-day job?
Yeah, all of them are certainly very important. You know, certainly looking at early childhood education, making sure that we have teachers in our schools, the mental health aspect, as well as making sure that our funding system is adequate for all our communities, because we do have, you know, wide disparities in resources depending on the community, depending on the zip code. And what's really unfortunate is we saw that before the pandemic. So, you know, I'm going to just say pre-2020. And then as we came through the pandemic, things just got worse, right? We saw that there was, you know, inadequate childcare, for example. And we saw that after-school programs were very difficult to come by. We see more teacher shortages now throughout the state. We also see fewer teachers staying in teaching. We know that mental health is off the charts, you know, in as far as need and anxiety, especially, you know, in our school age population. And then we, of course, are now going through a budget, you know, asking the legislature for funding for all of these programs. And so it was a need before I ran, and it just seems as though the pandemic exacerbated the need or exaggerated it further to the point where we are at crisis levels. And so I'm hoping things change. I'm hoping we get the resources. I'm optimistic considering we have such a surplus, you know, in our budget, or in our state coffers, I should say, of over around $7 billion now. So I'm optimistic, but I'm going to continue to fight for those things because that's what our schools need and that's what our kids need.
Mm-hmm. On the website of DPI, it talks about, it says, our vision, every child a graduate, college, and career ready. It remains unchanged. We want all students in Wisconsin to graduate from high school academically prepared. As you think about that statement, and as you know, I'm a local school board member in the Salem District in western Kenosha County. And if you were talking to a group of school board members, and not necessarily at the WBA, at the Wisconsin Association of School Boards, but if you were attending a school board meeting and just listening, what kinds of areas would you talk to a school board member who is making all those local decisions, since we do have local control here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I would just say that it's about our vision, right? It's about our collective vision. Local school board members set the vision and the outcomes for their school district. And then, you know, as far as, you know, when you talk about every child a graduate, that's a vision, you know, and it's really my vision for public schools is that they're strong and they're supported and they set our students up for success. And I don't feel that's any different than school boards at the local level. So I'm really excited to talk about budget. And that's where, you know, when you think about the local influence school boards have, is that they set the budget as well. You know, it's about their priorities as a board and what they want, you know, for their students in that school district.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of a good lead in to the budget ask. And I'm looking at six or seven bullet points here. Maybe if you could talk about the budget ask. And you know, everyone likes to say that, yes, everything is political. And we know what the political landscape is in the state in terms of having a Democratic governor and then, of course, having a legislature on both sides that are controlled by the Republicans. I mean, this is no secret to anyone. But maybe if you could talk about the budget ask and maybe highlight two or three important areas or areas that you think are really, really critical.
Yeah, and as you said, it is no secret it is political, but it really shouldn't be, right? Because I do believe that part of what we want is the same thing. I mean, we want our schools to be successful. We want our teachers to be, you know, well-prepared and staffing the schools, and we want our children to be successful. So the budget ask focuses on those common things, you know, just from listening to school boards, listening to districts, listening to parents. We needed to make sure that budget ask represented all those voices. So the flexibility and additional funding from the state to support our schools and students, you know, certainly we see lots of referendum getting passed throughout the state, which signals that people support their public schools. But we need to make sure that every school district has those opportunities. So we want to raise revenue limits. We want to improve and increase per pupil funding. We also know, listening to families and teachers, that mental health is a big issue. And so we wanted to put in their mental health resources and support, you know, modeled after the Get Kids Ahead initiative. Mm-hmm. Also, the special education funding. We have a very low reimbursement rate for special education services. And so we needed to put funding into reimbursing school districts for those services. So that's an increase there in special ed funding. And then nutrition. We know that, especially when we were in the pandemic, when we didn't have to worry about, you know, reimbursing or families didn't have to worry about paying or schools didn't have to worry about the reimbursement rates for breakfast and school lunch. We know that when they have full bellies and they are ready to learn, that was really what was behind improving that area and putting money into school nutrition. So like I said, we know there's a lot of support for public education. And so we wanted to make sure that the state was providing what they are constitutionally mandated to do, and that is to provide that funding to our school districts so that they could provide these services.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned special ed. One of my previous positions as a public school administrator was director of special programs that included special ed. As a school board member, I can't agree with you more that the funding needs to be increased, especially as students either with IEPs or 504s, and those are two separate areas that needs to be funded. Look into the future, and if you will, you know, snap your fingers and make things change immediately, what would you do and how would you do it in terms of really significantly increasing special ed funding?
Well, if I could snap my fingers, I would reimburse it at 100%, right? Because we know that our school districts transfer large amounts of money into the special education fund, which takes away from other things in the school district, such as building maintenance and facilities. It takes away from programming and other areas. That would be ideal. But what we did in our plan and what the governor has endorsed and actually made better on is looking at the fact that we only reimburse around 30% right now. This way, the plan was to gradually increase that. Ultimately, we'd love to get to 100%, but it was gradual. But we do have the means. It's just about priorities because, you know, if we were to increase special education funding, it helps students with disabilities and it helps students without disabilities. So it helps every student. And free access to public education is the law. And we need to make sure that we are providing the best education to our students with and without disabilities.
Mm-hmm. My last question for you, as you look back at your own education, particularly elementary, middle school, or high school, who was one teacher that you absolutely always remember who had a real impact on you in whatever area or subject matter it might have been?
I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I have one teacher in particular. He was my high school music teacher, high school choir. And being a very shy kid who didn't like to get out there on stage and perform with other people, it was one of those things that really brought me out of my shell, really got me to appreciate music. But he also brought in a community service aspect to our learning, and we would perform in nursing homes or in retirement homes. And sadly, you know, he's been deceased for a while, but I will never forget Mr. Holmberg, who really changed my life.
Well, you know, and real quickly, my high school choir teacher, Doris Ann Johnson, and another teacher, my history teacher, were two teachers who kept me in school. I was ready to drop out and join the military, which I later did in the Army Reservist for 7 years. But, you're absolutely right. You know, I think everyone, and I always like to ask that question, because everyone always has one teacher or more who have that sort of impact. Dr. Underly, I want to thank you for your time, and I know you're told this all the time. Thank you for what you do for the state of Wisconsin. And I'm saying that not only as a taxpayer and a voter, but also a school board member. I'm a parent, although my son is an adult now. But I want to thank you for all that you do and all that DPI does for education in the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate that. And thank you, too.
And we continue with this edition of Education Matters this morning. In this segment, I am interviewing Matthew Frazier. And Matt's U.S. Supreme Court landmark court case was decided back in 1986, where the court upheld the suspension of Matt, who delivered what was called, at least by many, a sexually suggestive speech at a school assembly. And the case involved free speech in public schools. We'll be talking about that, talking about the case. Matt, welcome once again to Education Matters.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here.
You know, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of you being suspended from school. You were suspended on April 26th of 1983 from Bethel High School in Pierce County, Washington. My first question is, does it seem like it has been 40 years?
You know, yes and no. I still remember it vividly, but yeah, a lot of time has passed. A lot of, you know.
Sure, sure.
But whether you look at national events or in your own personal life, it's a lot of time.
Sure. And we'll talk about the case and talk about exactly what happened. And I know you've been a guest before on Education Matters. We'll be talking about some different things. We'll be talking about your organization that you've been doing for 30 years with your summer camps and all kinds of exciting things. First of all, let me ask you this. When you look back now 40 years at what occurred at Bethel High School, and that was, I always forget, is that due north of Seattle?
Oh, it's about an hour south of Seattle.
Okay, hour south.
And about half an hour north of Olympia.
Okay.
There's that whole little bay there, and then sure. Olympia's at the bottom.
Okay. And let's talk first about the court case, and more so what happened prior to you getting suspended, and then we'll talk in more detail about the overall impact of your case, along with the Tinker case, and of course the cheerleader case, Mahonoy versus BL, Brandy Levy, which was decided about 2 years ago. But talk first about what happened in your own words, what led up to you getting suspended.
Well, I had a friend on the little speech and debate team at the school that I was on who was running for office. The school had decided that my debate partner, whose name was Matt Taylor, could not be the campaign manager for this kid because Matt Taylor was the ASB. I think he was the vice president himself. And so they just felt that it wasn't appropriate for him to also be advocating for a candidate. So the kid came up to me, you know, an hour before the assembly, 45 minutes even maybe, asking me if I could write him a speech and, you know, be his campaign manager. So I just asked him if he, you know, did he want me to just introduce him? Or did he want me to, you know, try to do something funny? Which, as you know, high school kids are far more likely to vote for the jokester than the hardworking advocate, you know.
Sure.
So I wrote this speech in about 5 minutes. He was in the room. I went around and showed it to a few teachers. The reaction ranged from my debate coach, Sean Madden, saying that he thought it was hilarious and I should do it, to a history teacher that I loved, named Stephen DeHart, saying that'll raise some eyebrows and you really know how to yank their chain, Matt Fraser, to the Spanish and journalism teacher who laughed, but then said, I don't know if I think that's appropriate. And that was sort of the biggest admonishment that I got out of any of three, you know, school representatives, was that they don't know if they feel that it's appropriate. Well, I was 17. I felt it was highly appropriate. Kids the prior year had, you know, done little stunts and, you know, we were high school kids, you know, there was innuendo in lots of things. It's not like I'm the only kid who ever used innuendo in school, you know. And remember, in our English classes, they were teaching Shakespeare, you know, and which is filled with sexual innuendo. And that's fine. Kids were telling jokes at lunch and all sorts of things said that this is fairly normal to my sort of inner sense of, was this okay or not? So I went to the assembly. I introduced this other kid, Jeff Coleman. I gave my brief speech, which has a few sentences, it's total, I think, six sentences. You know, it ends with, like, please vote for Jeff Coleman because he'll never come between us and the best our school can be. And it's just line after line like that in the speech. You know, the kids hooted and hollered and laughed, and then the assembly progressed. Jeff Coleman wins the election, but the school decides that what I said was inappropriate and that they were going to take action and suspend me from school for 3 days and disallow me from being graduation speaker.
Matt, I know you have read the speech exactly as you state, as you said it. In fact, on Education Matters a couple years ago, could you recite as much of it as you can? And
sure.
And I know I always say, now, did you emphasize that word or this word? So if you could recite it as you actually stated it and did it back in 1983.
Yeah. Now, this is from memory. Let's see if I haven't recited it in a few months here. I know a man who is firm. He's firm in his shirt, he's firm in his pants, and his character is firm. But most of all, his belief in us, the students of Bethel, is firm. Jeff Coleman is a man who takes his point and pounds it in. He'll take any issue and nail it to the wall. He doesn't attack things in spurts. He drives hard, pushing and pushing, until finally he succeeds. Jeff will go to the very end, even the climax, for each and every one of us. So please, vote for Jeff Coleman, because he'll never come between us and the best our school can be.
So my questions, and you know what I'm going to ask you, because I've asked you this before, any overemphasizing of any of those words? That's the first question.
I mean, I think I punch them a little bit when I deliver it, but, you know, not overly dramatically. The innuendo was there. They asked me at this very short federal trial, the first step of the legal battle, you know, they got me on the stand and they asked me, did I know that the speech, you know, was filled with sexual innuendo? Mm-hmm. And I was under oath. I had to answer, yes, I was aware that it was filled with sexual innuendo. Yes.
Now, sexual innuendo, your metaphors, your double entendre, prompting some action by the school. After you gave the speech, what exactly happened? I mean, relive the next 5 minutes, the next 2 hours, the next 3 days of what happened.
So the first 5 minutes, I go out into the hallway after the assembly. It's filled with kids. They're laughing. I feel like a rock star, or like I'm at Mardi Gras riding on one of the floats. Everybody's high-fiving me. Matt Fraser, that rocks. That was awesome. You should give every speech in the school. That was so freaking great. But after about 40, maybe half a minute, 45 seconds, in my recollection, after the bell had rung, because it was the end of the day, so everybody got out. We were in the hallway just, you know, getting ready, getting stuff from our lockers. And over the intercom comes, Matthew Fraser, do not leave campus. Matthew Fraser, come to the main office immediately. And then this audience of kids who had my back and thought it was the greatest speech ever, suddenly were just clowning on me with, aha, I'm busted. Oh, dude, you screwed up. Oh, you're going down hard. And it's... the crowd of teenagers, they're not very reliable backers. So I ditched the speech in Mr. DeHart's room in a book, because I just felt intuitively I wasn't sure I wanted to give them that. I went to the office. So within 5 minutes, I was in the office. There was a room with seven adults and one kid who was the student body president, who was supposed to be my representative, but wasn't remotely. She was, you know, a hack for what the school wanted and not at all on my side. So they, you know, they just asked a couple questions. They're like, you know, did you admit that you gave a speech at the assembly? Yeah, yes, I do. I did that. We know you were reading from a piece of paper. We can give us a copy of the speech. We'd like to see what you read. And I told them, well, I don't have it on me. And that was true. And I wouldn't have been shocked if they would have searched me. They weren't very good at follow-up. Because if they had pressed the issue, I'm sure within 5 minutes or 10 minutes, they could have probably had the original speech. Because I didn't want to lie. You know, I was astute enough to know that once you start lying, they can just you know, get you on that issue as school administrators. And that was something that the ACLU attorneys that I met with later that afternoon stressed from the start. Mm-hmm. So they ended the meeting after 5 minutes and said, okay, go home, write down word for word what you think you said. We'll see you here at 8 in the morning in another vice principal's office, and we'll go from there. So then I went home. I immediately got the number for the ACLU in Seattle. I called. When you call the ACLU, you typically speak with some kind of volunteer, often a college student or just a local citizen there. And they do what they call the intake meeting, where they just, you know, ask you to explain what happened. They write it down. What are you asking for? You know, what kind of help do you need or would you like to get? And then they, you know, call you back. So it was 4 p.m. I told them, you know, I really don't know what legal ground I stand on. Like, you know, did I have a free speech right to give this speech? Do you recommend, I have not given them the exact copy. Do you recommend that I give the speech to the school? So about an hour later, and I thought they'd shut down for the day and I was out of luck, the head, the executive director of the ACLU in Seattle, calls me back and says, Matt Fraser. She asked me a couple background questions, told me who she was. I didn't even really understand for sure that, you know, the executive director is the head person, you know, for the, all of the Pacific Northwest, I think it was, probably. And, you know, it was quite amazing that I was speaking with her just right out of the gates. But she quickly informed me that there was a conference call. In those days, you know, there was no Zoom or anything. Mm-hmm. You had to, you know, but they were set up to do this. So they had a conference call going on, she said, with the national ACLU office in D.C. or wherever it was. And they said a total of about 20 people who were experts on free speech and law professors and various civil litigation and civil rights attorneys. And they all agreed that, you know, on face, they didn't think that it had caused any trigger. They basically were comparing it to the Tinker case. Mm-hmm. And asking the question, did it cause a material and substantial disruption of the educational process? And so she was very curious about that. What, you know, did the assembly stop? Was there like violence at the school that I know of? Did anybody run down the hall, you know, breaking windows or anything? And as far as I knew, nothing like that had happened. I described the reaction and she was like, well, we think that it's definitely legal. It's a student government assembly where you should have the most possible free speech rights. And so we think that you were entitled to give it.
You mentioned the Tinker case. Had you heard about, did you know about the Tinker case that was decided about 14 years before that, as you stated, and you and I have worked with John over the years, and John's been a guest a number of times on my program here. But as you said, in the Tinker decision, when they were wearing black armbands, the court decided 7-2 in favor of the Tinkers that it did not cause a material and substantial disruption. Did you know about the Tinker case before your case started to gain some ground?
I think I was only vaguely aware of it. I really honestly became educated about free speech issues as a result of my own case.
Okay.
You know, I knew about the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never even really thought about the question of, you know, does that apply to kids? I kind of presumed that it did, which is why I called the ACLU in the first place. And then began to become aware that, you know, they have different levels of protection that they're willing to extend, you know, under a variety of circumstances. And their rulings even seem somewhat contradictory and in conflict with each other, even in the arena of high school speech. Mm-hmm.
As you look back at your case, if you were advising, and I know you do when you go to conferences and students talk to you, if you were talking to a student today who was going to give a speech of some sort, what kinds of advice would you give her or him with respect to be careful, don't be careful, make sure it's not disruptive?
That's such a good question. And the first thing that I try to tell people is to understand the Supreme Court precedent. These are four easy to read decisions that are the Tinker versus Des Moines with students protesting, the Vietnam War with black armbands, and the Supreme Court upholds 7-2, you said, that students do have constitutional rights to free speech, that they do not shed at the schoolhouse gate, and that there has to be material and substantial disruption of the educational process. So I tell people, don't do anything that's going to have students rioting, breaking windows, anything like that. My case is often misunderstood by even lawyers, law professors. I've been to classes at top 10 law schools with law professors who believe that the court held that my case was a material, that my speech disrupted the educational process. And I think it's pretty clear if you read the little, it's only, you know, 8 or 10 pages or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you read the decision, what they basically did was create an exception to the Tinker case. And they said that when it comes to juvenile obscenity, which is what they classified my speech as, they said it was, you know, bordering on lewd or obscene, mm-hmm. and it was some form of juvenile obscenity, which they said has a lesser standard than for adults, and we want to defer to the court. So they just didn't apply the Tinker standard. Sure. I believe if you read Morse v. Frederick about the kids holding up a sign saying bong hits for Jesus, they did the same sort of thing and created another exemption to Tinker, mm-hmm. because it clearly didn't really disrupt school. It wasn't even during school time,
right.
and nothing major happened the next day. And they just said that if it's going to promote drugs at school, we're going to give the school wide latitude to enforce the rules. So I basically encourage people to look at these cases, and then, you know, the Brandy Levy case you were talking about gets into school, you know, social media speech, mm-hmm. Outside of school, and that's sort of its own issue, which I was surprised at that decision, to be honest.
Yeah, and that was a 7-2 decision of a little more than 2 years ago, and we've talked about this on Education Matters. She held up her middle finger. She used the F word in a Snapchat on screen on a phone. Someone took a picture of the phone with her doing that, and she got suspended. This is a lead in to the things you've been doing over the last 30 years with your organization, Education Unlimited. When you're teaching and you're having people teach debate and you're talking about issues like this, how do you mesh together all of these court cases? You know, on one hand, Tinker in favor of the student, your case, Kathy Kuhlmeier in favor of the school district, and Joe Frederick in favor of the school district up in Alaska. And then we have the Mahonoy Brandy Levy case where they rule in favor of the student. When I look at it, and you know, I teach and have taught school law for 25 years, you know, it's a mishmash of things. And as you said, they really didn't say this, but they meant that. How do you teach that in a debate class and your camps that you run with Education Unlimited?
The most dead-on example is that we do a mock trial program. And the most common case that we use, we mix it up if we have returning students. So, but about half of the time, we use a case that I helped them write where, you know, you have two sides of the story, the school side and the student side, and we have a student hold up a sign in our mock trial that says something like, legalize pot to fund schools now. Mm-hmm. So it's basically, is that a pro-drug message? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you legalize pot to fund schools now, it seems more policy-oriented. But think, and it also attempts to get the students to understand the fine lines and sometimes absurdity of some of these Supreme Court rulings. Like, you know, how could it be okay to say legalize pot to fund schools now on a sign? And it's not okay to say bong hits for Jesus. which, as Joe Frederick says, is sort of, he's like, I didn't really mean anything except to combine religion and pot to annoy them. You know, he has said many times that, you know, I know you've spoken with him directly as well, I think. He, you know, his position is just that he wanted to yank their chain. And it was a nonsense statement. But to say bong hits for Jesus really is promoting drugs in schools. In teaching these things to people, you're doing your best to try to get them to analyze the facts of the case, the sentiment of where the court is. The court has really introduced themselves into a lot of these long lines of issues. And we've seen that play out with the really abrupt reversal of Roe versus Wade. That it's like, to some extent, I've told people, it kind of depends on the whim of the judges. I will tell you this, many schools that I've consulted with on this over the years, informally or formally, have sort of concluded, most of them conclude, we're just going to do what we want. And if the court, they said 99 times out of 100, this is how one administrator explained it. They were like, very few students are going to sue us over this, and we can't run around in fear of lawsuits. So we try to be aware of things like these few court cases. We try to do what's right and what our community wants us to do and what we think we need to do to run the schools. And if it goes to court once in a while and a judge has to decide, that's okay. On the other end of the spectrum, I won't name them, but I know one school district in California that had students doing a video, that had students who did a videotape for an election, and it had some inappropriate content and maybe some hate speech against racial groups. The kids just thought the video was a lark, but I believe that the school ultimately settled just out of fear of the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that that really encourages students to push the line further and further. The reasons why my speech was legitimate, I felt, it cannot be understated that this was a student government assembly of 1 hour specifically set aside for students to make speeches. They had every power to review the speeches in advance, but chose not to. So there are far less restrictive means than letting them punish me after the fact if a school wants to exert some control. Mm-hmm. And so I felt my case was, to circle back to that for a second, was one where it's really a pronounced case where I think the court is very wrong in its decision in that case, because they pay no attention to the, you know, they misstated the facts. They said there were 13-year-old girls in the audience. Well, my high school was a 10, 11, and 12 high school, and it was the end of the year. So it was basically rising 11th and 12th graders in the audience, and yet they tried to pretend in their rhetoric that there were 8th graders in the audience. Do you know what I mean? Well, that 3 years is a big difference. So you try to teach people the nuance. You try to teach them to approach it rationally. But these are issues that school district officials struggle with, and they also sort of have to make a decision. How much are they going to live in fear of lawsuits? How much is important to cater to their own community, and how important is it to sort of just make a statement to the students that the precedent is that they are going to fight for the right to control the schools? I think those are things for a school administrator to kind of bear in mind.
As we close this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD Public Radio, if you could talk briefly about Education Unlimited, the kinds of things that your organization does, and where you do these workshops and summer camps, so our audience can have an idea of what Education Unlimited is all about.
Absolutely, would love to. So Education Unlimited does summer enrichment programs for kids and teens, basically grades 4 through 12. For this coming summer, you know, we're still reopening from COVID. For two summers, most college campuses, or all of them, stopped running, allowing, you know, rent their own summer programs and stopped allowing other programs to run. So we are running at UCLA in California, Stanford University and UC Berkeley, and we're running at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. We also have an East Coast and a West Coast college tour. And it's a range of things. It's computer camps, public speaking, mock trial, various kinds of science and critical thinking programs, from psychology courses to neuroanatomy. We ran the last Sally Ride science camps. Mm-hmm. Sally Ride was America's first woman in space, mm-hmm. and we were her final partner on doing those camps. But then she passed away almost about 10 years ago now, I think. So we had to go on from that and just do them under our own brand, which was unfortunate. I think we'd still be partnering with her today, I would hope.
As you look at what you've done so far over the 30 years, East Coast and West Coast, what about here in the Midwest? You know, so many outstanding universities in the Midwest. You know, it's not just flyover country, but any thoughts about doing that in the future?
We would love to do that. The programs at a place like Georgetown are overnight, so we do get a lot of kids from the Midwest coming to programs, but it would be exciting to figure out the best place in the Midwest to host these programs. I think, you know, the students at the Midwest states perform incredibly well on a variety of measures.
Sure, you know, and obviously Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Missouri, Minnesota. In summary, 30 seconds, give us an idea of what you're looking at for the future.
Well, one thing I'm exploring is opening a nonprofit this year. We've actually begun to take steps to do that. And the nonprofit, which we'll just call the foundation, would be designed to provide these opportunities to kids who can't really afford it. Education Unlimited does do a lot of discounts and scholarships for kids, but I'd like to see that expand. So I'd like to get Education Unlimited back up to the 3,000 students a year that we had before the pandemic. That'll take 2 or 3 more years. And I'd love to have an actual foundation that is promoting programs like these to get kids and teens opportunities to really expand their horizons.
So if anyone wants to check out Education Unlimited, what is your website?
www.educationunlimited.com, and you can just click on there's online chat, there's phone numbers there, everything you need you can find at educationunlimited.com. And you know, even before this foundation starts up, we welcome students to apply for financial aid, and we typically will give discounts up to 50% off the cost of the program. And that puts it within reach of doing a little community fundraising, you know, through your local organizations, Optimist Club and things like that, and Kiwanis and your church. It makes it affordable, and we get, you know, typically 10 or 15% of our students on significant scholarship every summer.
Matt Frazier from Bethel School District versus Frazier, a landmark U.S. Supreme Court case from 1986. And as I said, you're celebrating the 40th anniversary of you giving that magnificent speech that got you suspended from school. Matt Frazier, thank you so much for being my guest here on Education Matters.
Very good. Thank you so much.
I'm Steve Brown, thanking you for listening to Education Matters today. My guests were State Superintendent Dr. Jill Underley and Matthew Frazier, talking about his landmark U.S. Supreme Court case. For WGTD HD, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.